Following podcast was recorded live at the Seattle Central Library on October 3, 2009. It was presented by the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library with the Elliott Bay Book Company. Podcasts and library programs are made possible through the support of the Seattle Public Library Foundation. For more information on these podcasts, please visit our website, www.spl.org.
I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the Central Library, and thank you all so much for joining us for this afternoon with Kate DiCamillo. So first, I need to thank the Elliott Bay Book Company and Kate's publisher for inviting us to host this event. Also to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs. And finally, to the Seattle Public Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. So now let me turn things over to Holly Myers from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest. Thanks.
I just want you all to know I wrote out my introduction, and it includes my name because I am so nervous. Good afternoon. Welcome. My name is Holly Myers from Elliott Bay Book Company. Before we begin, a few procedural notes. After her reading, our author will be available for a brief Q&A, and then she will sign books. For the sake of expediency, we are asking that only one book be personalized, but two additional books may be signed. We will not be able to accommodate personal or promotional items for autographing, and photography is allowed during the signing, but we will not be able to meet requests for posed photographs today. Her debut in 2000 with Because of Winn-Dixie amazed readers with its heartwarming story of love, loss, and a dog with a grin. Since its release, she has earned numerous awards and gone on to publish two picture books, a series of early chapter books featuring the porcine wonder Mercy Watson, four more novels, including her latest, The Magician's Assistant. And here, through the characters Peter, Adele, Bartok Wynn, Sister Marie, Madame Lavong, a luminous tale of hope, sorry, and belief unfolds. As an ardent devotee, can you tell? Is it showing? It is my belief that she is one of the two greatest living authors today. So please join me in welcoming the whimsical, the wonderful, the magical Kate DiCamillo.
How are y'all doing? I said to Holly, it's virtually impossible to come up to a podium after an introduction like that. So here I am, and I think I'll just stand here quietly for the next 45 minutes, and then I will have composed myself enough to sign your books, which is the easy part. But I actually have a speech today. I'm kind of distracted by the sign on the podium which says, please repeat question. It seems like really good advice, doesn't it? But okay, the speech, and then I thought I'd read to y'all from, has anybody read Magician's Elephant? Did you like it? Yeah, it's a terrible thing to stand up at a podium and ask that, too. Okay. So this is a speech that has a little bit to do with the writing of the book, and then I'll read to y'all. And then what I like to do is do question and answer, where you ask me a question, and I answer it in a roundabout way. So one of my first memories is of a magic trick. I was 4 years old and in the hospital. It was winter, 1968, Philadelphia. I had pneumonia, and I had been told by a nurse who was wearing an oversized, oddly shaped hat that I was a very, very sick little girl. She looked me in the eye when she said this. She put her face close to mine and arranged her lips into a narrow, disapproving line. I felt that I had disappointed her somehow. I was afraid of her and her hat. I was afraid of everything, really. For instance, there was a window in the hospital room, and leaning up against it, peering in, was a tree. Bare branch, dark-limbed, it looked like the skeleton of some monster to me. When the wind blew, the branches tapped against the window, and I was convinced that the tree was trying to find a way inside into my room so that it could eat me. I couldn't bear to look at the window, at the world beyond the tree. Instead, I stared down at the sheets of my bed, which were blindingly white, or I turned my head away from the window and looked at the polished yellow floor of the hallway. These things are very clear in my mind. The mean nurse, the skeleton tree, the white sheets, the yellow-floored hallway. I remember that it was hard to breathe and that I was hot and then cold and then hot again. I remember that I felt sorry for myself. I remember that I was afraid. And I remember the magic trick. The magic trick was this. My father arrived. He came into the hospital room wearing a black overcoat and a hat with a brim. The coat was unbuttoned. It flared out behind him like the cloak of a magician. In my memory, he was running as he entered the room, but I know that that can't be true. Why would he have been running? In any case, he arrived and stood in front of my bed and took the hat from his head and bowed to me and then held the black coat open and said, "Guess which pocket?" "That one," I said. I pointed to his right side. "No," he said, "guess again." "That one," I said, and I pointed to the left pocket. My father nodded and put his hand in the pocket of his coat and pulled out a red net bag and handed it to me. Inside the bag, there was a wooden village, a wooden church and a wooden barn, a wooden cow and a wooden pig, a wooden rooster and a wooden fox, a wooden farmer and his wooden wife, a wooden quarter moon and a wooden circular sun. Everything was the same size. The cow was as large as the church, the rooster as big as the barn, the pig as round as the sun, and everything, each thing, the woman and the man, the fox and the moon, was painted in outrageous and vibrant colors, orange and yellow and green and purple and red. In my feverish state, this seemed exactly right to me. It was right that all the things of the world were the same size, and it was right that they were as bright and astonishing as the figures from a dream. It was right, too, that I could hold them, all of them, cupped in my hands. My father sat down on the bed next to me. He helped me spread the wooden village out over the sheets. "Look at this rooster," he said. He held the rooster up to me. "Isn't he a fine figure of a chicken?" I nodded. He picked up the pig then and held it next to the rooster. "And look at this pig," he said. "She's beautiful, isn't she?" I nodded again. "What if," said my father, "what if the beautiful pig falls in love with the handsome rooster?" I laughed. "No," he said, "really, imagine it. What will the farmer say when he hears the news?" "I don't know," I whispered. It was hard for me to talk. My chest hurt, and also I was afraid of my father, afraid that I would give him the wrong answer, say the wrong thing, disappoint him, anger him. "What if," he said. I shrugged. "Imagine." He said the word gently. He didn't seem impatient or angry. I was quiet for a long time. My father waited. Finally, I said, "Maybe the rooster is named Antonio." My father nodded. "And the pig?" "She's called Beatrice," I said. "Yes," said my father. "And maybe the farmer is happy." "Really?" said my father. I nodded. "Tell me more," he said. "Maybe the farmer is happy that Antonio and Beatrice are in love, and maybe he says that there should be a wedding." "A wedding," said my father, "for a rooster and a pig." He raised his eyebrows. I nodded. "Isn't it lucky then that we have a place where they can be married?" He picked up the wooden church and handed it to me. I don't remember what happened next. I don't remember the wedding. I don't remember Antonio and Beatrice getting married. I don't remember if they lived happily ever after. I only know that at some point my father left and I was alone in the hospital room. The skeleton tree was still there, pressed up against the window, watching me, but I wasn't bothered by it. Dusk descended, evening crept in. The overhead lights came on and the hallway outside my room became a molten river of gold. The nurses sailed up and down it wearing their ridiculous hats, muttering their words of doom, "Very sick, very sick, very sick, little girl." And I didn't care. I didn't care because the whole world was there on the sheets in front of me, and I could turn the pieces of it, the fox, the rooster, the moon, the barn, over and over in my hands and make anything happen. Anything could be. I understood for the first time that darkness, sickness, loneliness, fear could be pushed back by the act of imagining, by naming the things of the world, and by then asking myself the wonderful question my father had asked me, What if? What if the cow runs away from home? What if the sun refuses to shine? What if the wooden farmer decides he doesn't love his wooden wife? I could tell myself a story. It was magic, a magic trick. And so it should not, I guess, surprise me that some 40 years later, at the end of one of the worst winters of my life, during a time when I was deeply, profoundly afraid, another magic trick occurred. This time, an actual magician appeared before me. He did not literally appear, of course, but I saw him so clearly that he might as well have been standing in front of me. He wasn't a very impressive magician. In fact, he looked desperate. His cheeks were unshaven, his black coat was dirty and dull, his hair was greasy. He stood in front of me and he held himself very still. He waited. I waited too. I waited for him to pull a rabbit from his hat, flowers from his sleeve, but nothing happened. He only looked at me, pleading, beseeching. It took a while for me to truly see him, to understand who he was. A man tired of tricks, weary of rabbits and flowers. He was a magician who wanted nothing to do anymore with illusions, sleights of hand. He was a broken person who wanted still, in spite of his brokenness, or perhaps because of it, to perform real magic, true magic. What if, I thought, what if this magician succeeds? What kind of true magic will he perform? I felt for the first time in a long time that wonderful surge of hope, light, the coiled and glowing spring of a story burning inside of me. The magician disappeared, and I took out my notebook and started to write down what I had just seen. I described the magician. I took notes about what he wanted to do, and then I began to imagine. I asked myself, what if? And I found that the answer to that question involved a boy named Peter and a girl named Adele, and also an elephant and a nun, an old soldier and a beggar, a blind dog, a countess, a stone carver, a noblewoman, and her manservant, a small policeman, the small policeman's wife, a white dog, a river, an orphanage, snow, music, dreams. Now, almost 2 years later, you're holding that story, those answers to that what if in your hands. And you will want to know, what is the magician's elephant about? There are two ways to answer that question. Here's the first way, the traditional way. The Magician's Elephant is about a boy named Peter Augustus Duchin. Peter is an orphan. He has a sister named Adele. He has been told repeatedly that Adele is dead. Peter's heart, however, tells him otherwise. He visits a fortune teller and asks her to speak the truth. The fortune teller says that this is difficult since the truth is a forever changing thing. And then she tells Peter that his sister is alive and that an elephant will lead him to her. So the traditional answer to the question, what is this book about, is The Magician's Elephant is the story of a boy who has become separated from his sister and sets out to find her, sets out to put things to rights. But there is, too, a more complicated way to answer the question. And the more complicated answer involves my own heart and that dark winter that I lived through. There is a moment in The Magician's Elephant when Peter thinks this terrible thought. The world is broken and it cannot be fixed. That was the cry of my heart when I began this story. But in the book, Peter's despair is answered, echoed, counterbalanced by the small policeman, Leo Matian, who speaks these words, what if? Throughout the book, Leo says the words again and again, over and over, gently, relentlessly, without fail. And as I wrote the story, as I worked, I too began to believe again in the marvelous what if. What if the magician performs real magic? What if a brother and sister are reunited? What if the rooster falls in love with a pig? What if the impossible happens? So the answer to the question, what is this story about, is this. This is a story about despair and fear being transformed into hope and possibility. This is the story of a magic trick much like the first one I knew. I've decided that my father was running the day he came to visit me in the hospital. I can see him racing through the winter streets past the bare branch trees. His coat is open, flapping behind him like wings. He is running up the stairs of the hospital, taking them two at a time. He is working to get to me. He is coming to save me. He is bringing me a wooden village in the words, "What if?" He is becoming because he loves me. He came because he loved me. The world is broken and it cannot be fixed. But what if? What if we hope? What if we believe? What if we imagine? What if we tell a story? What happens then? That is what The Magician's Elephant is about. It's a story about a magic trick, yes, which is to say that it is a story about love, the greatest, the best, the grandest magic trick of them all. Now I'm going to take a sip of water, and then I'm going to make y'all ask me questions, and then I'm going to read to you. Does anybody have any complaints so far? Surely you have questions. I can step out from behind the podium now that, yeah. The question was, where did I get the idea for The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane? And happily, there's a simple way to answer it, which is that somebody, a dear friend, actually gave me a rabbit doll as a Christmas gift. He's like this tall, and he's dressed in this very fancy outfit, and he's really quite creepy looking. And I was like, wow, thank you. It's still not a gift I really understand, but I love the person that gave it to me. I took the rabbit home. I put it on the couch in my living room, and every time I walk into the living room, it scared me. And like maybe the third night that the rabbit was in the house, I had the dream, and this is where things get kind of creepy, and you see what a disturbed person I am. I had a dream about the rabbit underwater, face down on the ocean floor, with no clothing on. Yeah, so there you go. I'm in therapy, no worries. And it was such a compelling image that that's where I started. I thought it was going to be a picture book. I thought it was just a picture book about a toy rabbit that, and I thought it would be relatively simple to tell it. But as soon as I started, it just kind of like opened up. And it's the only book that I've ever had that I can say kind of just like wrote itself. I just showed up. I don't know where it came from, other than the rabbit. Yes. What inspired me to make the Mercy Watson books? Writing is really, really hard for me, and the only part that's easy are names. And one day I was on a plane, and I had this like pig face pop into my head with like the word Mercy underneath it in neon letters. And I laughed because I thought, oh, that's funny, a pig named Mercy, you know? And so I jotted it down in my notebook, and when I got back home, I started trying to write it, and on and off for like 2 years, I tried to tell the story of Mercy, who lives with Mr. and Mrs. Watson, and how they've lost sight of the fact that she's a pig somewhere along the way, and it seemed funny to me, but I could never make it work. And then one day, pretty soon after I'd gotten a new car, I was taking a friend to the airport, and she got into my new car with an enormous piece of toast. And it was like slathered in butter. And it was a really objectionably large piece of toast. And she ate it in my new car, spraying greasy crumbs everywhere. And I finally said, do you have to eat that in the car? And she's like, you just don't understand toast, do you? And so then she went on in this impassioned, truly impassioned thing about toast and how good it was and how it was better if somebody else buttered it for you and how they should butter it all the way to the edges. And by the time I got rid of her, I knew what was missing in the books with Mercy. It was that she loved toast, and that was the missing element. And as soon as I got all that together, the pig and the toast, it worked. It was, yeah. Yes. What's one of my favorite books? They feel kind of like my kids to me. Mm-hmm. So I can never like say, are you an only child? You got brothers and sisters? Is your mother here today? They're out in the library. Shall I go get them and say, which of your children do you love the best? And they seem like my kids. Your mother would say that she loves you all equally, but differently because you're individuals, and it's that way with the books. I see them as deeply flawed, but lovable anyway. Yeah. What motivates me to write? I don't know. What motivates me? The world makes more sense if I have a story. And I always am waiting for the story. And I never know when it's going to show up. I show up and write 2 pages a day, whether I have a story or not. And I just find that I'm much happier if I'm doing it than if I'm not doing it, which is kind of funny when you think about it, because I don't really like doing it. But there's a wonderful quote from Dorothy Parker, I hate writing, I love having written. And so every day when I've done it, it's like, that's the best thing ever once I've lived through it. Yeah. The very first book that I wrote was because of Winn-Dixie. I kind of had a charmed existence in publishing, because it was a book that I didn't. But prior to that, I had written a lot of short stories and sent them out into the world, and I had I was at about 470 rejection letters before I sold anything. You know what a rejection letter is? Kind of like, how can I sum it up? It's worse than an F, because it's like, we don't like you, we don't like your story, and we wish that you wouldn't send us anything ever again. You know, I got a dartboard. I would come home from work, a rejected story would be waiting for me, I'd take the letter, I'd put it up on the dartboard, I'd throw darts at it, and then I'd package up the story and send it out again. Yes, right here. Favorite books, you know, you can ask me now and you can ask me 3 minutes later and you're going to get different answers. I love Eudora Welty. I love Flannery O'Connor. I love E.B. White, Katherine Patterson, Christopher Paul Curtis. Is anybody, Watson's Go to Birmingham, 1963. Do you all know that book? Fabulous, fabulous book. Yes. Which book did I have the most fun writing? It's like degrees of suffering. Which time, I'm rephrasing it to myself, which time did I suffer the least? Edward Tulane did really kind of write itself, so that was nice. And I always have a fun time writing about Mercy Watson. You know, when you write books for kids, everybody always kind of looks at you and says, now, what lesson did you mean to impart here? And Mercy is my answer to that, because nobody ever learns anything in those books. They're a triumph for idiocy, you know? It's just like, no one changes, no one grows, there's no moral message, you know? People just eat toast, you know? Yes. It's good that we have this question, because the question was actually phrased to me as, how do I choose the illustrator? And I don't. And this is a common misunderstanding. It's like, I have virtually nothing to do with it. I'm kept in the loop. I have what's called rights of refusal. But it is very much something that the design team does in conjunction with the editor. And so not only am I not choosing, I am not speaking to the person at all as the whole process is going on. We're kept separate. My editor is here today, and I've given her a lot of theories about why I think that is. My favorite theory is because writers are so neurotic that you don't want them talking to the illustrator because they'll scare them, you know? But I've been incredibly fortunate, and Candlewick is the publisher of most of my books. They're geniuses at picking the right illustrator. And so I'll see sketches along the way, but I never talk to the illustrator until it's over with. And the stripes right there. Yeah, Bryce breaks my heart. I actually can't even really think about Bryce without starting to tear up, because he has to walk away and leave Edward there so that he can get fixed. I don't know where Bryce came from. I never know where any of the characters in my books come from. People always say, do you base them on people you know? Nope, I don't. It's just like they're people that exist and I get to discover them. And Bryce is one of my all-time favorite characters too. He breaks my heart. Yes. Where did I get the inspiration for Because of Winn-Dixie? I grew up in Florida, and I moved to Minnesota when I was 30 years old, and my second winter there, which was the worst winter on record in Minnesota, and I give each of those words emphasis because it's a truly alarming statement to say the worst winter on record in Minnesota, because it's roughly the equivalent of Siberia there. It was like, there were like 5 or 6 days in a row where the high was 35 degrees below zero. And you like open up your car door and pieces of it fall off, which is really confusing to you if you grew up in Florida. So I was homesick and I wanted to go back to Florida and I could not afford to move back. And but I could write a book that would let me go back home because that's where Winn-Dixie is set, is in Florida. And also it was the first time in my life that I'd been without a dog. And I was experiencing what I call dog withdrawal. So like if I was in a car and there was a dog in the car next to me, I would beep the horn and wave at the dog, you know, it was that bad. And so I couldn't have a dog in the apartment where I was, but I couldn't make up the best dog that I can imagine. And I can tell you all of that in retrospect, but at the time I didn't know what I was doing. I started with one line for that story, which is, I have a dog named Winn-Dixie, and the rest of it, you know, it's only afterwards that I can see kind of where it came from. Right here you've got a lovely scarf on. Yes. The characters in the movie, because Winn-Dixie looked like I imagined them when I was writing the book. Absolutely for Miss Franny Block, who was Eva Marie Saint. She was wonderful. Also for Cicely Tyson for Gloria Dump. Dave Matthews, while it was thrilling to have him there and he did a great job, that wasn't how I imagined Otis. Otis was not quite that good looking. but it was super. I was willing to let that go. And, you know, it was an astonishing thing to watch that all unfold, but I didn't have any control over it. You know, you never do. No one really matters less in Hollywood than a writer, you know. So Wayne Wang, who directed that, happened to be a director who likes writers. And so he had me come out to the set, and I worked on the screenplay and stuff, but it was just like a gee whiz kind of thing. You've got white on. Yes. How do you feel when your books become movies? Well, there's a variety of responses there. One of them is that there's still a part of me that can't believe that I got published, much less that, you know, the books are read. And then the next level of that is that, you know, this little thing that you imagined is on the large screen, and it goes literally all over the world. I guess the words are surreal, fever dream, unbelievable, and sometimes I wake up laughing. How's that? Like, you've got to be kidding me. Yes. What was the inspiration for Tale of Despero? It was my best friend's son, who was 8 years old at the time, and Winn-Dixie had just come out. And he looked at me with newfound appreciation. It's like, wow, you wrote that, you know, before I was just kind of boring and dull. So he took me aside to give me a talk about a story idea that he had that he thought I might want to write. And he said, it's the story of an unlikely hero with exceptionally large ears. And I said, that sounds interesting. What happens to the hero? And he said, I don't know, that's why I want you to write the book. So that's where I started. And by the time Despero came out and won the Newbery, he was almost 13 years old, and I made him go to the big banquet, you know, and stand up. He was disgusted by the whole thing. It's like, Luke, stand up. And he's like, it was just like, so it takes a long time to make a book, and he was too old to be impressed by the time it came out. Yes. The question was, and I'm going to answer you honestly, even though it makes me look pathetic. The question was, do I ever cry when I'm reading my books? I made the mistake once of a little girl asked when I was going around for Edward Tulane if I could read my favorite part of the book, which is towards the end when Abilene comes into Lucius Clark's shop. And I lost it. You know, I literally had to, like, I was at a podium, and I had to do this. And say, just give me a minute, give me a minute. And it's really, it's embarrassing because technically I made it up, you know, and so I shouldn't be weeping over it. But also, with The Magician's Elephant, there's a part in that book where I start crying, and I cry all the way through to the end. So I don't know what my problem is. All the way up in the top is a red shirt. What inspired me to start writing books? I had failed at every other possible career opportunity. I mean, that was it. I'm what you call a late bloomer. And I knew for a long time that I wanted to write. I was in college, and a couple of professors took me aside and told me that I should consider graduate school. The exact phraseology was, "You have a certain way with words, you should consider graduate school." That's what they said. And what I heard was, "Wow, you're really talented. You're going to be a rich and famous writer." And so I thought, great. And I got myself a lot of black turtlenecks. And I sat around. I'm not kidding. I wish I was kidding, because this part of my life is just very dark and ugly. I sat around in my black turtlenecks and looked kind of bored and disdainful. And everyone go, "Oh, that's Kate. She writes." And so that's how I spent the whole of my 20s. And then right before I turned 30, I realized that I was never going to be a writer unless I wrote something. And so at 30, I started to write. And I'm 45 now, so I've been doing it for 15 years. For the first 6 years, it was nothing but rejection letters. And then slowly things started to happen. Yes. How long did it take me to write The Tale of Despero? It was, I think, like a year and a half and 8 drafts. So I wrote it over from the beginning to end 8 times. If you guys ever go to Minnesota, and I know that's on your list of places to go, there's a wonderful collection at the University of Minnesota called the Curlin Collection, where you can go in and look at children's books, authors and illustrators, their work. You can go in and see all the rough drafts of writers' work as they work their way through a story. And you can see how you would put absolutely no money on being able to finish that story. Yeah. Yes. To my knowledge, did my father perform any other magic tricks in the course of his life? No, other than giving me that love of story and kind of like showing me the doorway to step through. And also, when he was around telling stories, he was a good storyteller himself. Magic. Stories are magic, I believe that. And if he did any other magic, it's just the cheap kind like the magician did. Sleights of hand, that kind of thing. Quarters out of your ear. Yes, right there. Yep. Do I have any pets? I have, for lack of a better phrase, a part-time dog, since I have commitment issues. His name is Henry, and he's a very bad dog. He's part poodle, part terrier. And I always have this vision of, so he belongs to one of my best friends who lives about a block and a half away from me. She works in a bookstore. She drops him off in the morning. And I always think, oh, a writer, you know, with a dog at her feet. And whatever room I go into, Henry gets up and goes into the other room. And he spends most of his day on the couch with his head hanging off of it, snoring as I work. So he's a great comfort. Yeah. Right there. Yep. Do I still have the wooden animals? I don't. And I thought about that so much when I was writing. I can see them so clearly, and they just had this profound impact on my imagination. And I wonder who the humorists were that made them, that made everything be the same size. You know, the moon as big as the barn, and it was an astonishing little collection. And the red net bag, I loved them. Yes, and pink. Mm-hmm. That's a lovely question. And Edward Tulane, is Sarah Ruth based on me? Because Sarah Ruth actually has, I think it's probably consumption. I don't know. I never really thought about what it was. But she has this long thing. She coughs up blood. She ultimately doesn't turn out well. And is that character based on me? No, but I spent so much of my childhood being sick that I have a very pointed memory of what it's like to spend all day in bed with the rest of the world going on around you, you know? Yeah, so that's a good question. Right here. Yep, you. How long did it take me to write Because of Winn-Dixie? Because of Winn-Dixie, because it was the first book, was an absolute breeze. I had no clue what I was doing, so I just, like, it took me 6 months. I was like, wow, that's great. It was also one of those things where I didn't think it would ever get published, so I thought I might as well amuse myself and make myself happy. And so because of that, I didn't feel as, and I didn't think anybody would ever read it. So it was, I think, 5 drafts, 6 months. Yes. Do I like the movie The Tale of Despero? I do, very much. I think it's beautiful. I think it's, of course, very different from the book. But I can appreciate it as a movie in of itself. And the fabulous thing about somebody making your book into a movie is that all kinds of people find their way to the book that never would. And so it's just like a great thing for the book. And I got to meet Dustin Hoffman, and that was exciting. Yeah, it probably wouldn't excite you as much, but it was very thrilling for me. And he came to the press conference with a hamster in his jacket pocket, and he was sitting up there, and he just slowly opened it up and took it out and put it on the table, and so that was funny. Yes. Do I ever feel like I don't like what happened in the books to the characters that I write? Yes, it's Tiger Rising is probably the best example of that for me. How that book turns out, I spent weeks and weeks trying to make that not happen, but finally I had to like give up and let the story do what it needed to do, and I wish that it had turned out differently. And the red right here, yes. How did I get the idea for The Dungeon and The Tale of Despero? It's kind of what it feels like to be writing a novel, is to like be really, impossibly small and armed with a sewing needle and to go down into a dungeon. That's very much what it feels like to be writing a book, at least to me. There must be some happy writers out there. I'm not unhappy. I mean, you would like to stand next to me at a party, but yes. So I'm supposed to say the question back, which is going to be very difficult in your case, but I'm going to try to like paraphrase, and you can correct me at any given juncture. The question is, seemingly I have a faith in humanity and that we will find a way to survive and to hope and to love. Where does this faith come from? I don't know. I do know that I have it. And I didn't know that I had it until I started to write. It's one of those things where writing stories has revealed so much of who I am to myself, and it is there. There is this profound hopefulness in me that I didn't know that I had. So I don't know, I might even be a happy person. It could be, I don't know. Who am I missing? You haven't said anything. To make Otis be a criminal and because of Winn-Dixie? Well, it's always fun when you can toss a criminal in a story because then, all bets are off about what's going to happen. It introduces a properly dangerous element. And I didn't actually know that he was a criminal right away. It took me a while to discover that. But he's a criminal in the name of music. So he's not really a bad guy. He's just a misunderstood guy. Two more questions. Oh, should I read? We don't have time for that. Okay, we've got a plan. Okay, two more questions and then I'm going to read a little bit from The Magician's Elephant. Yes, you. Can I describe what happens between the first drafts and the last drafts? I write by doing 2 pages a day. And so that first draft, what counts as 2 pages is 2 single-spaced pages where I pay absolutely no attention to anything. I don't bother with punctuation, and I don't stop to spell. I just get the 2 pages out. It's kind of like a rough map, and I'm feeling my way through it. I'll talk to myself as I'm doing it. So if you went to the Curlin and you looked at that, you would be very embarrassed for me because I'll go, okay, don't panic. You've got it. Just keep on going. So I'll do that in the first draft. When I go to the second draft, I double space what counts as 2 pages then is 2 double-spaced pages. And I start to pay more attention to the conventions of grammar and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. With each draft, I find my way through the story more better and more clearly for me. And also, I'm fine-tuning the language as I go. So it's a kind of a crescendo, sometimes a crescendo of failure, sometimes a crescendo of success. Who's going to ask the last question? You look so sincere, I can't resist you, yes. Do I have any advice for young authors? The most important thing that you can do is read. And the second most important thing you can do is listen. It's a wonderful thing to be able to talk to people and to hear their stories, and it feeds your imagination in a way that very few other things do. And then, of course, you should write, which is something that a piece of advice that I didn't follow my own self for those dark 20s. But you need to find some deal to make with yourself about doing a certain amount of writing each day, 2 pages, a page, whatever. Just make a commitment to yourself to do the work. Reading is, of course, probably the most important thing there. Okay, speaking of which, can I borrow somebody's elephant book? Thank you very much. So I'll just do a little bit from chapter 1. At the end of the century before last, in the market square of the city of Baltis, there stood a boy with a hat on his head and a coin in his hand. The boy's name was Peter Augustus Duchin, and the coin that he held did not belong to him, but was instead the property of his guardian, an old soldier named Vilna Lutz, who had sent the boy to the market for fish and bread. That day in the market square, in the midst of the entirely unremarkable and absolutely ordinary stalls of the fishmongers and cloth merchants and bakers and silversmiths, there had appeared, without warning or fanfare, the red tent of a fortune teller. Attached to the fortune teller's tent was a piece of paper, and pinned upon the paper in a cramped but unapologetic hand were these words: "The most profound and difficult questions that could possibly be posed by the human mind or heart will be answered within for the price of one florin." Peter read the small sign once and then again. The audacity of their words, their dizzying promise, made it difficult suddenly for him to breathe. He looked down at the coin, the single florin in his hand. "But I cannot do it," he said to himself. "Truly I cannot, for if I do, Vilna Lutz will ask where the money has gone, and I will have to lie, and it is a very dishonorable thing to lie." He put the coin in his pocket. He took the soldier's hat off his head and then put it back on. He stepped away from the sign and came back to it and stood considering again the outrageous and wonderful words. "But I must know," he said at last. He took the floret from his pocket. "I want to know the truth, and so I will do it, but I will not lie about it, and in that way I will remain at least partly honorable." With these words, Peter stepped into the tent and handed the fortune teller the coin. And she, without even looking at him, said, "One floret will buy you one answer and only one. Do you understand?" "Yes," said Peter. He stood in the small patch of light, making its sullen way through the open flap of the tent. He let the fortune teller take his hand. She examined it closely, moving her eyes back and forth and back and forth, as if there were a whole host of very small words inscribed there, an entire book about Peter Augustus Duchin composed atop his palm. "Huh," she said at last. She dropped his hand and squinted up at his face, "but of course you are just a boy." "I am 10 years old," said Peter. He took the hat from his head and stood as straight and tall as he was able. "And I'm training to become a soldier, brave and true. But it does not matter how old I am. You took the floret, so now you must give me my answer." "A soldier, brave and true," said the fortune teller. She laughed and spat on the ground. "Very well, soldier, brave and true. If you say it is so, then it is so. Ask me your question." Peter felt a small stab of fear. What if, after all this time, he could not bear the truth? What if he did not really want to know? "Speak," said the fortune teller. "Ask." "My parents," said Peter. "That is your question?" said the fortune teller. "They are dead." Peter's hands trembled. "That is not my question," he said. "I know that already. You must tell me something that I do not know. You must tell me of another. You must tell me..." The fortune teller narrowed her eyes. "Ah," she said, "her? Your sister? That is your question? Very well. She lives." Peter's heart seized upon the words. "She lives. She lives." "No, please," said Peter. He closed his eyes. He concentrated. "If she lives, then I must find her. So my question is, how do I make my way there to where she is?" He kept his eyes closed. He waited. "The elephant," said the fortune teller. "What?" Peter said. He opened his eyes, certain that he had misunderstood. "You must follow the elephant," said the fortune teller. "She will lead you there." Peter's heart, which had risen up high inside of him, now sank slowly back to its normal resting place. He put his hat on his head. "You are having fun with me," he said. "There are no elephants here." "Just as you say," said the fortune teller. "That is surely the truth, at least for now. But perhaps you have not noticed, the truth is forever changing." She winked at him. "Wait a while," she said. "You will see. Thank you." Thank you for being here. Thank you so much.
This program was presented by the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Thank you for listening to this library podcast.